This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Today, we're joined by Zach Sunderland, a licensed architect and general contractor who leads both the design and construction teams at Haven, a certified B Corp based in Durham, North Carolina. With experience across sectors and project scales, Zach is passionate about working directly with communities to design and build exceptional places to live, work, and play. At Haven, he's helping increase the quantity and quality of housing options for underserved populations, creating spaces where everyone has a chance to flourish and thrive. Zach Sunderland, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
So good to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you here. I love what you're doing. I love design build. I love that as a model. And I love that you're serving underserved communities. And I also love that you like talking about business, which I like to talk about business. So we're going to mix all that together. We're going to learn about Haven and the things that you do and how you do them. But before we do that, I want to know more about you. I want your origin story. When did you discover your passion for architecture and the things that you do? And who or what inspired you to get started?
Happy to share it. I'll try to be as brief as possible because, of course, I could talk about myself all day. But my background is in construction, actually. So that's kind of where I started. I grew up in what I'll call lower income socioeconomically. I say I grew up in a trailer park. I don't know that folks will say trailer parks anymore, but that's always how I referenced it.
Well, if that's where you lived, then that's what it was.
That's what it was, yeah. And, you know, growing up, I never really even noticed or cared. It was just normal for me. That's great. But I did my typical teenager, worked at a food service spot and really disliked it. And so I met someone who was doing construction. I got a job with them and I fell in love pretty much immediately. I had been an art kid doing art throughout middle school and high school. Was planning on going to school for graphic design and ended up when I fell in love with construction, saying, hey, there's something to the ability to put something like this together and create something before your eyes. And so when I was looking at my actual program I would do, I switched to architecture. And what I ended up falling in love with architecture was thinking about where I came from, the impact that the environment you grow up in, the environment that you live in every day really, really has an impact on you. And the things that you can do with the built environment to serve people and to really be intentional about creating a lifestyle. And so I ended up in college going and serving in Haiti shortly after they had the earthquake there. And what I was there for was not building related directly. I was actually trying to get a little bit of a break from architecture school. So I bought a one-way ticket to Haiti. I knew a Haitian guy. So I said, hey, let me come out there for the summer, see where it goes. And I had a great, great, great experience. Ended up not in an urban environment, but in a rural environment, and spent a lot of time with folks there. But it got me far enough away from the program to explore what it made sense for me to do with a career and put me on the trajectory for social impact and diving deeper into what architecture can do in that world. And so that's really what got me along the path that I've been on ever since. Of course, finished architecture school, worked at an architecture firm, a couple architecture firms at the early part of my career before deciding to start the company.
Were you based in North Carolina all along? Did you grow up in North Carolina?
I was. And so I actually grew up near Denver in Aurora, Colorado, and then went to college at Iowa State University. And then we moved to North Carolina. A little bit about the company's origin story. I met my business partner in undergrad at Iowa State University. He started architecture, but wisely dropped out, switched over to communications, and then did a graduate program in business. And while he was doing his graduate program, I was working in Des Moines, and I really did enjoy it quite a bit. But I wanted a change of scenery, and I knew I wanted to go somewhere and wanted to do impactful work. And he and I had conversations while he was doing his undergrad about what it might look like to work together. And so when he was graduating from his master's program, I said, hey, wherever you end up, as far as your work goes, I'll get a job there. I'm an architect. I can, you know, there's a place for me kind of in any place he would go where he would find work. And that ended up being Raleigh, North Carolina. So then once shortly after he got placed somewhere, we found a job out here and moved out here as well. And when I say we, me and my wife, we moved out here in 2015.
And so you moved knowing that you wanted to start a firm with your partner?
Yeah, I knew we wanted to do work together. He had a finance focus. He's our CFO. And he had real estate experience mixed with my construction architecture. We actually originally thought, hey, how can we work together in the world of resettled refugees? That was the initial thought. And as we began exploring it while we were both working our full-time jobs, we ended up coming up with the idea for Haven about a year and a half after moving here.
So what's the mission for Haven? Why did you launch it?
Yeah, you said our mission statement at the onset. We exist to increase the quantity and quality of housing options for underserved communities. And every word in there is intentional. We certainly spent a lot of time thinking about what it should look like and what it could do. Thought about, hey, should we be a nonprofit? And what kind of work can we do as a nonprofit? Should it be a for-profit? And what kind of work and constraints do we have there? We decided to do a social enterprise, which I know we'll probably talk about a little bit later, B Corp, which is a for-profit, but with a mission orientation. And so as we were exploring what it could be, I was working in a firm that did a lot of multifamily housing, the kind of developer, large-scale multifamily housing in the area. At work, I really did enjoy, and a firm that I enjoyed. But I saw that we were creating hundreds and hundreds of units in these urban centers. And we weren't creating any affordable housing. And I was just curious, what's the reason? What's the decision-making factors that are going into the fact that we're creating so many units and none of them are affordable? What are the constraints and what are the economics of it? And so I started digging into just learning about that, learning about the process of how affordable housing is created. And from there, that idea, that the education that I had within that world, decided there's a real opportunity for someone to do professional services dedicated explicitly to affordable housing, which is really where we started. And about 9 years later, we've really been able to do quite a bit of work in that world, which has been a really, really sweet fruition of that vision.
Yeah, I love that you're mission focused. I love that you've found a specific niche to focus on from a business point of view. That's really smart. But you said you learned how affordable housing is done. Can you explain how it is done? I mean, how do you build a business designing and building affordable housing and make a successful business out of it?
Yeah. So as you can imagine, it's complex. The answer is multifaceted, right? And so what the first thing I came to understand was the definitions around affordable housing. What does affordable housing even mean? And certainly there are various forms of it, right? When we look at the highest level definition of affordable housing, it's about how much a household pays for their housing costs compared to their income. And that's by housing size. So I won't get into all the acronyms, but there's area median income, AMI. That's the HUD designation that's based on an area and household size. So one person or two or three or four people. And they say, hey, here's the median income for that range of households. Now, affordable to that person is 30% of their income going towards housing costs. If they're over 30%, their housing cost burden. If they're over 50% of their income, they're severely housing cost burden. And so if with that just broad definition, then you can start kind of picking apart affordable housing into different components. Is it housing for people experiencing homelessness or really basically knowing? Or is it housing for low-income folks that are working, that may have housing, but are burdened severely by their housing? Or are we looking at workforce housing? And even, you know, you look at higher income earners, they still have housing costs and can be housing cost burden. Certainly, that happens a lot in most of the country. Even a significant portion of your middle income earners or middle to high income earners, we might think of as like middle class, are housing cost burdened. We're spending more than 30% of our income on housing. And so with that kind of broad perspective, each of those components, what I call targets, they're generally financed in different ways. So if you're doing housing for somebody who is experiencing homelessness, there will likely be grants both on the front end, your capital expenses, actually building the project. Even before building it, there's typically financing for your professional services, then financing, typically grants, lots of philanthropic dollars, money from local or state or federal government. A lot of funding comes from the Housing Finance Agency at the state level, which administers funds from the federal government. So the most typical version of that is the low-income housing tax credit, also known as LIHTC. And that's the most common, if you hear about affordable housing, that's most commonly what people are talking about. Typically, those are mixed income, but not mixed income in that it's high-income earners and low-income earners. It's 40% area median income, it's 60% area median income, 80% area median income. That's where mixed income. So various degrees of subsidy on that housing cost. But then there also would be, there's also subsidy for running an apartment or managing the apartment afterwards, after it's built, because if someone doesn't have an income, they'll need some sort of subsidy to maintain and stay in that unit. And so there's different ways of doing that. There are the housing choice voucher, which is previously known as Section 8. There's housing choice vouchers that are dedicated to a specific project. So typically the housing choice voucher stays with the person or the household. So they can go to any landlord that's willing to accept them. Then there's project-based vouchers, there's veteran vouchers, there's this and that. So it's all over the place. And we don't focus on necessarily any specific one of those things. We try to serve lots of different, because there's such variety and the need is such variety, right? There's no one solution that solves the housing needs for these different vulnerable communities, whether it's rental or home ownership or apartments or townhouses. There's, you know, we want to create housing options because that's going to be where we have the most longevity, highest likelihood of success for these households. So that's the affordable housing side. Now, as far as how to make it a successful business, what we, generally speaking, affordable housing costs the same, maybe even sometimes a little bit less, sometimes a little bit more than your market rate housing. Certainly not the same as luxury housing, but if I was to build an apartment building, I got bank financing for, that was just going to serve the typical market, the building is not going to be any cheaper to do it for somebody who doesn't have an income, right? That's still a building that has to be built. And so your, generally speaking, your design fees, your construction fees, they're all going to be very similar to what it would be on the market rate. So just the same as the firm I was working for that was doing all that developer work, you know, they're getting paid for the architect's work. I'm not doing anything pro bono. Getting paid for all my architecture, getting paid a normal amount, getting paid for my general contracting services a normal amount. And so what we wanted to do is two things that help us be successful in this niche. One is design build. As you mentioned, you really like design build. For us, we're really firm believers that design bid build does several things that are very challenging in the market. Well, one is a contentious relationship between architects and contractors, which we believe is unnecessary. Generally, we try to create a culture where we look at both sides as people that are really vital, which they are in the process. Well, my design team will look at my construction team and say, they're the heroes here. Like, they're the ones actually making this thing happen. Well, my construction team will look at my design team and say, they're the heroes. They're, without their vision, we wouldn't be able to build anything. And so to really balance those two pieces. And I can talk a little about how we do that culturally internally later. But design build also, of course, has some natural efficiencies. One team, we're able to be more cost effective with our fees, with even our estimates. Like, how do we make sure that we have cost informed decisions on the front end so we're not redesigning things towards the end of the process? And we have a through line. So our team is with the client from start to finish. And that's really important for this specific niche because a lot of, certainly some of the clients we have are professional developers. This is what they do all day, every day. They know what they're doing. They're sophisticated. They're good. But a lot of the people we work with are, this might be a one-off project for them, or they might develop something every decade or two decades. It's not necessarily, they're not professional developers. What they're in the business of, or what they're in their nonprofit or community organization, what they're trying to do is serve those tenants well. They're trying to serve those households well. That's what they're good at. Building a building is sort of a burden for them. And so because it's our niche, because we've created an environment dedicated to specifically that, we can be good guides on that process. We can be effective guides. We know where their pain points are. We know where they might be lacking information or lacking clarity and kind of bring in and provide that clarity. And so we're able to work with and create an environment that we're known to be good guides in this process. So we end up getting a lot of these projects, which is really helpful for us because some of them take many, many years. It takes a lot longer, typically. I shouldn't say that. It's not holistically true, but generally takes a lot longer to create these housing with these complex capital stacks and compliance and all these things than it does a market rate development or a non-subsidized development.
So are you serving primarily North Carolina or do you work all over the country?
We're just in North Carolina for the time being. We're based in Durham, as you mentioned, and we've been doing a lot of work in the Triangle, so Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill. We are working with a group out of Wilmington, just a couple hours away for us. And that's our kind of first footprint expansion. We also work kind of in between spaces as well. Sanford, North Carolina, and other places. But, you know, our goal is to expand out. We have a very small team. We are a very small firm. So our reach isn't super broad at this point.
Do you do any development as well, or are you just architecture and build?
Yeah, so we've done some development in the past. We definitely have a vision for partaking in development. I can talk about this as well later, but one of the things that we do specifically as our company, as a social enterprise, part of our financial management and our financial strategy is that as we have extra at the end of the year, at the end of our operations, we try to invest it back into strategic things, one of which is invest it back into housing as well. We've had limited opportunities and limited success with that. And so we've had some lessons learned. We have one really great project we're a part of, which is a low-cost tax credit project in Raleigh. It's called New Bern Crossings, which is currently being built. And that's about all of our capacity at this point as far as the development side. But that is something that we do navigate, which gives us, it's not our focus. We're focused on being service providers. We're focused on serving our clients well. But the knowledge that we gain from doing development ourselves does help give us some insight into helping others navigate it. Even though we don't say, hey, it's real estate consulting, to say, hey, it's concept design, but we're also going to talk about your pro forma because we know we need to talk about your pro forma.
Right, exactly. Talk a little bit about B Corp. What is a B Corp? How does it work? Why did you choose it? How does it help you do the things that you're doing?
Sure. So B Corp certification is a third-party certification program. The nonprofit behind it's B Lab is the name of the nonprofit, but most people just know B Corp. And B Corp is really just a rigorous third-party review of all of your policies and operations, kind of giving you a score, and you have to be above a certain threshold for that score, saying that you have been reviewed and approved as a social enterprise, right? So we're not just saying, hey, we're a social enterprise, we're a mission-focused company, but then we have a lot of this stuff behind the scenes that nobody sees that we could be doing anything with. We're not a nonprofit. We don't have these disclosures. We could keep everything hidden. And so what the B Corp certification forces us to do, one, it forces us to define things. So we have a robust set of policies on how we run our company, from how we work with our staff to our clients, to our suppliers, as well as how we run operations. We also have to track a lot of data, which we would anyways, but we track a lot of data about our projects and about our finances, where money goes, where money comes from. We report that every 3 years. And B Corp, the B Corp, so B Lab, the B Corp recertification process takes a while, 6 or 8 months, for them to review all that data, ask for more information. And it's, again, really the purpose for us. At the beginning, we knew we wanted to be a social enterprise. The purpose for us was two parts. One, to differentiate ourselves in the market. Last time I looked, we were the only certified B Corp architecture and construction company in North Carolina. So some differentiation there. But also, it gave us a framework for understanding the things we should think about in our business to have a bigger impact. So we could say, hey, we're going to have impact because we're going to focus only on affordable housing. Well, that's good. There's a lot of other things we wouldn't have naturally thought about. And B Corp helped us by asking pointed questions. Hey, how are you investing in your staff's professional growth? How are you caring for them in conflict? What's your policies around bonuses, all these sorts of things. And that really helped when we were getting started. It took a long time, but it really helped when we were getting started to push us to look into things that we just wouldn't naturally have looked into.
Are there tax benefits as well?
No.
So similar to a C Corp?
Yeah. So we are an S Corp technically, but we are just a regular corporation. So tax-wise, legal-wise, we function exactly the same. Now, other places actually have a designation, other states have a designation benefit corporation. And that can be tied to the B Corp thing and where it started. But North Carolina does not. So we're just a normal corporation. And this is just a third party, kind of like certified organic designation on top of that.
Got it. So it helps you in your marketing differentiation, and it helps you stay focused on your mission by having somebody hold you accountable to the things that you're saying you're going to do.
Absolutely.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, RCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of Detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at rcat.com under the Resources tab. Or just go to rcat.com/arcademy. That's ARCAT.com/ARCATEMY. That's ARCAT.com/Arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. You talked earlier about your design side and your build side, and that you actively work with those teams to build a healthy culture to respect and work with one another. Can you talk a little bit about that culture that you've built?
Yeah, and currently always building, right? Always trying to invest in maintaining appropriate focus on the mission and trying to be always bringing people back to why we do what we do. I think a lot of the reason why the folks that work for me, you know, I have excellent staff. I think the reason why we're able to attract good talent is because there's a desire to do meaningful work. And certainly you can do meaningful work in a lot of different contexts, but the work that we do, I mean, I can tell you stories, but some of the work that we get to serve and to be on the team for is super impactful and really rewarding. So we, in regards to the design build culture, there's firms out there that'll do design build as a project delivery type. But that means they're going to be in an architect firm, they partner with the GC. Or they're a GC firm, they partner with the architect. There's even companies out there that say they're design build, but really they're a GC that has an architect they know who to call, right?
Right, yes.
And so there are firms in our area, direct competitors, who do actual design build. They have architects and general contractors in-house. And that's the model we do. So I personally am an architect and a general contractor. I got my general contracting license right after starting the company. And I couldn't tell you which one I'm more of, an architect or a GC. Honestly, neither at this point. I'm more of an entrepreneur than I of those two things. I can't do all those things, which is where a great team comes in. The way we've structured our company, we've tried many different things to get to this point, but we've navigated those waters and intentionally came up with a structure where we have project teams that have a project architect and a construction project manager. So our project managers, one on the architect side, one on the construction side, and then site supers, of course, are focused on job site quality and safety and subcontractor management. We call that our triangles or diamonds if there's multiple projects and multiple site supers. And we keep those teams together. So it's never like this project architect's working with this CPM and this CPM. They're working with the same person on every project over and over and over again.
And they're assigned right up front. When the new project comes on, those people know that they are assigned to that project and they work together.
Exactly. And so even at concept design, the project team meetings, the project architect's talking about this project, the construction project manager's familiar with it. They're helping them with any of the concept pricing that we put together. They're in it from the beginning. And the client knows who that person is too. So they already know their team. And what we had been doing, and I'm sure a lot of design build firms do this, we sort of had an architecture department and a construction department. And the architects would just get a project, and then whoever was available on the construction side when that time came would just get passed to them. So they're kind of all working all over the place. We felt like one team and another team.
Right. Sort of a design bid build, but in-house.
Yeah, not that dissimilar than the normal process. And so when we brought people together in teams, there was a lot to work through, right? Of course, it was navigating those waters. It's new for most people. it's a team that they're not naturally or haven't in their careers been a part of. And so we do team forming sessions where we kind of come together and we talk about different roles and responsibilities. We talk about each person as an individual. We use Enneagram for the workplace. An Enneagram is just a personality model. They say every model is wrong, but some are helpful. We find this one to be helpful. We use one called Truity. They have one that's dedicated to the workplace. And we're not trying to assign a number to somebody, but what it does really well is it gives a framework just to like have words to use when talking about, hey, whether it's right or wrong, hey, this reflects my personality really well, or it doesn't reflect my personality at all. At least now I have words to communicate that.
Do the other team members know what the other team members' numbers are so they have a context on communication?
Absolutely. So that's what we work through together. Every time we form a new team, even if we end up, because every once in a while we have to restructure it. So even if we restructure, even if it's temporary, we always do a team forming session. And part of that is just, hey, let's understand one another well so that we know how to work together well, but we know each other's roles and responsibilities. We know how to hold one another accountable. And so I do coaching every 2 weeks with each staff member. But then I also sit down with the whole team periodically. And we just bring that stuff up again. Hey, how's this working? How's this not working? And I'm often just revisiting that conversation about what design build can do if we're coming and doing these things together from an architecture and a construction perspective. And, you know, I think if it wasn't constantly revisited, it's easy to fall by the wayside. You're busy, you have work to do, you're not thinking about that. So I'm always trying to bring it up. Always trying to bring it back to the conversation, to the forefront, to kind of create that culture that then carries through. And it has a real impact on our client's experience, which is ultimately one of the main goals, is we're working together as a team to provide great guidance for our clients. So their experience is they're not only satisfied, but they're also successful. They've achieved what they've sought out to do. And we can say, hey, we didn't achieve anything. We were just good guides helping our clients find the success that they're looking for. That's what they're paying us for.
What are some of the biggest challenges that you've overcome in building your teams?
Well, yeah, several, right? We've had architects who just cannot fit in that model. They do not want to work with the construction team, not directly at least. They just have had so much experience having the construction team being someone else, and then their team is just the design team, which is a environment which is super fun sometimes. It can be hard, but it can be fun to just be like, hey, we're all designers here. Well, that's not true in this setting. So now with hiring, every time I make an offer to somebody, I go, okay, you don't know what this experience is going to be like, but let me try to paint you a picture. I want you to be coming into this eyes wide open. I want you to know that this experience will be different than other experiences. And let's talk about it. And if it's not a good fit, I'm really sorry. But we need to talk about it so we know whether or not it's a good fit. And now that I've known to look out for that, my batting average is up. But it was a challenge at the beginning. And additionally, on the construction side of things, you know, most construction professionals are not as zealous and dogged as architects are.
Yeah,
I'm trying to use good but also intense words. You know, architects can be very intense, very singularly focused, and that can rub other professionals the wrong way. People who are very good at their jobs but do it differently, or maybe not as passionate as an architect tends to be. Certainly there are builders out there that's just different kind of approach to being a professional. And having to navigate that well, both setting expectations for the architects on the team, as well as trying to smooth the edges for the construction folks so that the tension is not always bad, but so that the tension is constructive, so that the things we're working through is constructive. Nobody's just taking things the wrong way, which again is why we have to keep revisiting these conversations, not let it go too far for re-anchoring and saying, hey guys, we're on the same team. Like, you know, this is who we are. This is our roles and responsibilities. And always kind of coming back and revisiting that.
Do you do any sort of team building exercises that bring these people together in order for them to learn one another's personal sides and so they can become more friendly with one another? And so when they do have opportunities where they're having challenges. It's a different vibe when you're dealing with somebody you know and like than somebody you just know them on the surface as work people.
Yeah, we do. We do quarterly team building stuff, and we try to have an environment where we're not just all super focused on just what we have to do, but also how we do it and why we do it. And so we'll do things like training. We'll kind of all come together. And I'm not just training the architects here. I'm training everyone. We're talking about the bigger vision altogether. And, you know, with the small office, we're 12 people total. Generally speaking, everyone gets known.
Yeah. Yeah. With a small firm, it's a little bit easier to connect with one another.
Yeah. It's our site guys that might feel disconnected more often. And so I try to bring the site guys in. You know, they always have a hesitation to coming into the office and sitting through me talking for an hour.
Right.
But hopefully at the end of it, they always feel like it was worth it because we're trying to, nobody's an island. Nobody can function that way. We don't want them to feel like they're disconnected from us.
Yeah. What's your long-term vision for Haven? 5 years or so? What does it look like?
We're looking for regional growth at the moment. This is really, you know, I have this mentality around growth, right? In business, we always hear, you know, if you're not growing, you're dying. And there's probably some just basic truth to that. But I always pause and tell myself, like, why am I growing? Why do I want to grow? If I'm growing in the ways I'm growing, I always want it to be to multiply the impact. Growth should always be, if I'm investing in growth, it's so that our impact can have either wider breadth or be deeper. And so one of the things I've cast for a vision for our company, you can find this on our website, it's a little buried, but I cast a vision housing 1 million people in 100 years, right? And I like talking about this because, especially from an entrepreneurial perspective, 100 years is a long time. I don't plan to be here in 100 years.
Yeah, it means you need to build something that's going to outlast you.
Exactly. And a vision that is in line with the mission can be carried forward, but look like so many different things. What is housing 1 million? Like, of course, I set metrics and I set goals for who's being housed and what type of housing and those sorts of things. And I track it and I do an audit and I try to report every year what we're doing. But like to house 1 million people, even in 100 years, we have to get to a certain size, right? And so kind of casting this big vision, saying, this is a vision that is going to be why and how I navigate growth, but also whomever I bring in over time to take my place and to take my business partner's place, they're going to also have to be bought into that vision. Like that's going to be the place to go. And so for us, we really want to grow regionally because the ability to serve regionally is not too intimidating. Serving places like Wilmington, Charlotte, Asheville, Richmond, Virginia, the, you know, kind of growing kind of a concentric circle. But the needs are so great in each of these local communities for affordable housing. I know it's, the need is similar everywhere, but the opportunities we have to come in and to share the things we're learning here with those different communities, especially those urban centers, but out from the urban centers as well. And so I would love to see what we're trying to work on is local offices. So I could serve everywhere from, at least on the architecture side and construction management side, everywhere from Durham. But our goal is to actually set up local offices in each of these places. We have clients in Wilmington. We're serving them from Durham right now. But the goal is within the next couple of years to have an office there with Wilmington staff who know Wilmington, who are spending the time building relationships and understanding the community, because the work we do is so integral and in some ways can be pretty hard to navigate because of the different people in the community might have different perspectives on affordable housing. And should we do it? And where should we do it? And how should we do it? And so I don't want to be like, hey, I'm from Durham. I'm going to tell you how to do affordable housing in Wilmington.
Right, like,
I want Wilmington people to do that. So that's our vision. And we're kind of moving in that direction. But one thing we've learned over the last 9 years is we're going to let things pull us there. We're not going to try to force our way in. And so we're currently being pulled to Wilmington. So that's our starting point.
Sounds like a very exciting vision and a very exciting future for you. As we wrap things up here, as an entrepreneur, architect, and general contractor, What would you say is one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I appreciate that question and haven't had a ton of time to think about it. But I think one of the most important aspects, we've learned a lot through making bad decisions as a company and kind of making the false start and then, you know, trying something didn't work. And I think that's great. I mean, failing quickly, getting to a no quickly is almost as good as getting to a yes, right?
Right.
And so there's an aspect of sometimes you try something, it doesn't work. But we've also, through that process, learned to open our ears a little bit more to other people's insights. Part of it was starting with the cathartic process of complaining to people about all the, you know, things that we've done wrong, come to realize, oh, actually, that's pretty typical for a small business. These aren't things that we're experiencing just because we're bad at it. It's lots of things that are happening because there's cycles and it's the nature of being an entrepreneur. And so we've gone out more and more and talked about the things that we've done and the things we've experienced and asked people about their experience, which has been enormously helpful and encouraging to know we're not alone. You know, they say it's lonely at the top, right? When you're an entrepreneur, that is absolutely true, especially if you're alone. I have the benefit of having my business partner who's started with and still is, by some miracle, a close friend of mine. And so we're still close friends. And so he and I have camaraderie there. But especially if you're a solo entrepreneur, even if you have business partners, getting into networks of other business owners, other entrepreneurs, especially small business owners, there's a feedback loop there that can provide a lot of encouragement as well as information, guidance that our ears were just closed off to at the beginning. We just weren't listening. We just wanted to do it our way. And over time, have found a lot of benefit in doing that.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. That's the mission of Entree Architect, of bringing the knowledge of other architects together so they can learn from one another. So I totally agree with you. His name is Zach Sunderland. The firm name is Haven Design Build. You could also learn more about them, havendesignbuild.org. So make sure you type .org. Havendesignbuild.org is the website. Zach, thank you for the work that you do, for helping provide homes for people who need them. Dedicating your career to that. It's a very important mission. I'm glad that there are people like you out there doing that work. I'm glad that you're building a successful business around it and being an example to others to show others that they can do it too. So thank you for that. And thanks for coming by here and sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate it.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link to this episode with a friend. Either just click the share button or highlight the URL and send the link to this episode with a friend, because that's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. Throughout the 10 plus years of Entree Architect, that's how we've grown, architect to architect. So I would love for you to share this episode and all the episodes with one friend every week. We'd love that. And thank you to our sponsors for this episode. We don't have an episode if there's no sponsors. So thank you to our sponsors. Links to those sponsors, which you should go visit and click, and all the resources that we discussed today for this specific episode, they are all available at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Every episode that we've recorded is there, entrearchitect.com/podcast. Go click the links to the sponsors and say hello. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. You should go visit that at gablemedia.com. That is the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to select episodes of this podcast, Entree Architect Podcast. Yes, AIA CEUs for listening to a podcast. It's there, and many other podcasts are there as well. And you can listen to all of them and get credit. Learn more about our program, Gable Members Program, at the gablemedia.com/members website. That's gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, join us today at Entree Architect Network. That is the worldwide organization for small firm entrepreneur architects. If you own your own architecture firm, you are an entrepreneur architect. You are an entree architect. With weekly live group business coaching, yep, we have business coaching there, monthly live business training with AIA CEUs, 2 a month, so 24 AIA credits per year, including 12 of those are HSWs. We have them in the membership. Business resources, all the resources you need to run your business, special session webinars, mastermind groups, and a thriving community of small firm architects just like you. Hundreds of architects are there waiting for you to join. So we provide the support and encouragement you need to succeed as a small firm architect. I know that you haven't been trained as a business person when you launched your firm. That's what we do. Come learn how to run a business at Entree Architect Network. And today you can go join right now for free for 30 days at this link, entrearchitect.com/30days. We'll give you free 30 days for membership. Go check it out at entrearchitect.com/30days, and I will see you there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I want you to remember three words: love, learn, share. Have a great day. Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.
Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.